Right on the button, guys. Right
here, last
guys.
Stone for Kevin Martin. They want it on the button. The fans are on their feet. Kevin Martin goes out as a champion.
Anyway, here we go. Here we go. Launching another episode of Inside Curling. Hi again, everybody. It's Jungle Jim Jerome with you. And joined, of course, by the one and only Kevin Martin, the greatest curler in the world, World Hall of Fame. As I've always said, God, I love that business card. That's a strong business card, Kev. Okay, World Hall of Fame and best curler in the world. And, of course, another World Curling Hall of Famer, Warren Hansen, or as I like to call him after all these shows we've done, Kevin, strap in. You better know what you're talking about. How's it going, Warren?
It's great, Jim. Getting some warm weather out here finally, as I think you are as well. So
yes, we are. Kevin,
perfect.
This is shirts and shorts weather, Kevin. It's minus 14. It's down 10 degrees. Anyway, coming up on today's show, we got a bunch of stuff as we do each and every week. Warren, we got your poll question that you're going to bring us that we love to talk about, which asks the question, which teams will qualify for the final eight of the Scotties? And also we get responses on this Facebook page that you came up with, Warren, and people are constantly weighing in on that, and we'll get an update on that. Kevin, you made a mistake. You have a correction to make from last week. Did you understand that? Okay, I've got it marked down.
Well, there's a mistake by somebody, which I'm going to correct, but I don't think it was me. but that's okay.
We'll give you the teaser. We won't tell you what that is. Of course, we get emails. We're going to go over some of those. And also, we'll let you know, because the Scotties and, of course, the Briars coming up, what Inside Curling plans to do during that time. But our biggest feature on today's show is we have a guest. We love the shows where we have a guest. And Helen Radford has agreed to join us. And she, like you, Kevin and Warren, looks like, I was reading some stuff this morning, many, many highlights, but looks like she's devoted her entire life to curling, particularly from the coaching ranks, which she's done everything and has devoted a lot of her time and particularly her job now to youth curling. And Helen joins us all the way from Halifax. How are you, Helen?
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, well, it's good to have you on. You guys have to allow me. One of my most favorite Briars was Halifax. You got to allow me 5 seconds, Warren. It was the greatest theme song ever written for the Briar Patch. And it was Nokia who was the sponsor, the one I went to anyway.
A sure thing.
Yeah. And it was like this. It was, it's a sure thing. Here in Halifax, it's a sure thing we're going to party in the patch. Nokia Briar, it's a sure, sure thing. Do you remember that, Helen?
I do. I remember that.
I'll tell you what. They are the most friendliest people in the world. I'm not lying when I say it was my favorite Briar, and I've been to a bunch. The highlight was everyone I ever ran into there, immediately when I first walked into the patch, people said hello. And a couple of guys said, what's your name? And I said, it's Jim. They all, welcome, Jim. You ever been to Halifax? I said, no, it's actually my first time when I was there. And they said, you got to come and stay at the house. Check out of your hotel and come and stay at the house. Pure strangers asking me to come over to their house. I loved it. You're there now, Helen. First of all, tell us, catch us up, what's going on with COVID down there. Everyone likes to know what's happening around the country.
Well, we feel blessed to be here in Nova Scotia. We've got a great medical officer who's kept us in check. So we hardly have any cases. I think we might have 9 cases, maybe 10 active ones. So it's, and most of the cases that we get are travel from outside Atlantic Canada. So we've been wearing masks for a long time. I'm happy to say the kids are in the gym playing, in the arenas playing. So we're playing sports. The kids are in school. We're keeping our numbers low. So, you know, we're thinking about everybody who's struggling out there, but we're happy to be where we are.
So how are they handling curling there?
You can still curl. So you can go to your league games. You can practice all of those things. No tournaments. So no championships or things like that at this point.
So tell us, Helen, a lot of this show that we sort of came out of left field a little bit has always focuses around, obviously, curling, but a lot of talk about Curling Canada and you know, managing provincial bodies and all sorts of stuff about the game. You're with Curling Canada now. Tell us what you're doing there and how you're spending most of your time with Curling Canada.
Well, I started in this role in 2016. So this is a fairly new role for Curling Canada. I know when Warren was with Curling Canada, there wasn't somebody who was specifically focused on youth curling. So we've spent a lot of time and done a lot of work in the last 4.5 years on working on our long-term curler development. So taking a look at all of our programs that we have from the playground to the podium. And I would say that, you know, you're starting to see some of the programs coming out. We've been rolling them out sort of slowly, but they're all tied to our long-term development of our athletes.
And how's it going? How is with youth curling? We're on the rise. It's good, positive.
Yeah. So any of the numbers that we see youth curling, the numbers are growing, especially in the sort of our younger sort of teenagers to early 20s. So we like to see those numbers. Obviously, this year has been disappointing for a lot of your youth players. Lots of clubs weren't able to open or even run youth curling this season. But we're really excited about where we're going, sort of the direction that we're moving in. We work closely with the MAs. We meet with them every month. So we've got constant conversation about the strategic pillar of building youth curling and how important it is for our sport.
Tell us, Helen, how that would roll out, say, with a member association. If you have a new initiative for youth curling, and I know there's a couple of them that you want to talk about, how does that all start and how do the clubs get involved in the member associations?
Well, I think the key is when we went back, I worked with a committee of quite a few people, and when we looked at sort of the gaps throughout the system, we definitely recognized there were a lot of gaps on the youth side. For instance, when I started, there was really only under 21 nationals and the Canada Games every U18 every 4 years. So we had tons of gaps in our events. And in Curling Canada, you know, we want to work collaboratively with our MAs to build our system. So it's not just, you know, to have a one-off event here. We want to make sure they're all kind of tied together. When we have ideas and recognize gaps, that's one of the nice parts is every month we have Operations Advisory Council meetings and youth curling is always on the agenda. So I usually get an opportunity to speak about things that we're working on, whether it's at Curling Canada or if I'm piloting something with a member association, able to give some feedback. So there's ongoing consultation that goes on a regular basis with the MAs. So they're in tune and in line with what we're doing. And they give us great suggestions. We give them suggestions and we kind of work together to roll out the various programs.
How young are you starting these how old are these kids when they can start in curling? The youngest?
Well, that's where the clubs and the MAs kind of get involved. We don't get involved too much on the really young side, but they do start pretty much at U9 or U12, under mm-hmm. 9 or under 12. We do have a program that was started in Ontario. Curl Ontario started a hit, draw, tap program, and that was modeled after punt, pass, kick, and drive, chip, putt. Right. From other sports, and that's taken off really, really well. So the member associations run that. That's an individual event where kids throw a hit, they throw a draw, they throw a tap, and get scored on it, and go to their events. And that's a Curling Canada program now. Mm-hmm. So we start sort of as early as that. We do help write and present programs to MAs for them to use. So for instance, we created an under 12 learn to curl program, an under 18 learn to curl program, a campus learn to curl program. We've got school programs. We've got all kinds of different programs that we write, we pilot, and then essentially give to the executive directors to use with their member associations. So we do help provide some of the programs that we've recognized have been gaps. Mm-hmm. But the you know, the executive directors work really well together, and some of them are doing fabulous work around the country. So they also share best practices. So we hear what they're up to as well.
You're busy. Warren?
This has always been an interesting issue with curling, in the fact that, you know, I look towards the MAs and the clubs who really should be responsible fully for that younger development. But then Curling Canada as the NSO should be the ones that are primarily trying to develop and expand the high performance element. And with a lot of sports, that seems to be a fairly clear line, but certainly before in the past, this was always muddied to some degree as to whose responsibilities are where. And so where does that sit today? Do the MAs now pretty much totally take the responsibility of these programs, say up until 18, which is maybe when the high performance end of it comes into things? Or how does it all work out? Where's the division? Who's responsible for what?
That's a great question, because I think before, Curling Canada didn't have anybody who was responsible on the youth side. So when I jumped in, I was able to spend some more time and work with the EDs and you know, their staff to take a look at the different youth programs. So it's not muddied anymore. So the MAs and the clubs, they do take over the younger side and the development of it. We just help support with programs and work with them together. And, you know, our first event at U15, which I'm sure we'll talk about at some point in time, is sort of the first time Curling Canada jumps in, and that's more of a skill development tracking opportunity for us. And then, yes, we jump into U18, then U21 and things like that.
Why don't you talk about that U15 program? Because you just put a release out in that a couple of weeks ago. And as you say, it's new, and what's exactly its focus and what's it aimed at doing?
Yeah, so we're really excited about this. We were actually hoping that this event was going to happen this season, but obviously it didn't. So we're calling it Curling Canada's Under 15 Rock Fest. So what this is, when we look at our long-term athlete development model, Under 15 still falls in the fundamental stages and skill development. And we know a lot of the MAs already currently run some kind of Under 15 event, whether it's it is a provincial or it's just like a, you know, jamboree style or whatever. So they all already focus on team events. So what we wanted to do is really focus on the skill development side. And plus, we don't have a lot of data. We don't have a lot of tracking at the younger ages. So creating singles, and this is something that Jerry Peckham and Rob Krebs have been talking about for years. So all of these programs that we're rolling out have been in the works for a very long time. It is specifically targeted at singles, and at U15, the kids will throw 6 shots, and they'll throw interns and outturns. So it'll be 12 shots in total, and there'll be 3 draws, 3 hits. And we've built the app. We were going to release it this season. We're going to wait till next season. And with it, it's showing us, we've got a practice component to the app, and we've got a competitive or a competition component to the app. So kids and their coaches can use the app and practice the shots over and over and over again, and keep the scores within the app. And then we can run competition pieces to it, where we can take their top scores, and we've got a leaderboard so they can kind of see where they rank amongst them, you know, other kids in their own province or territory, and they can also see where they rank across Canada. What we want to make sure is, we want to make sure that the skills are appropriate for that age group. So at U15, we offer 2 mulligans. So the kids will throw their 12 shots, and they can redo 2 of them to sort of help their score. And that also, you know, encourages them to, you know, not feel that pressure on, oh, shoot, I missed that shot. You know, they get an opportunity to kind of redo it. And, you know, while we were in COVID, we actually built the app out even more. So we've got the opportunity actually to run singles for U15, U18, U21, and U25 plus. So I work in the next gen program, and we'll definitely be, you know, working that in. And the shots are definitely appropriate for the age and stage of the athletes. So shots at U25 are not scored the same as they are at U15. And they're obviously more shots as the kids are older than when they're younger.
So this, you're beginning to build a book on these players. Is my assumption correct?
Yes, absolutely. That was done deliberately.
Yep, that's perfect, because this goes back to the questionable Olympic trials in 1987, where we did start to build a measurement process, and that's pretty much what we used at that point in time, was a lot of the shots from points curling. And it's fabulous that we're finally getting back to that point of being able to somehow assess people. How does that sound to you, Kevin?
Well, you know, first of all, yeah, I want to thank Helen for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. I really want to talk to you about this U15 Rockfest idea. And that's not so much in a way that Warren's thinking, but I think so much about trying to compete with other sports for the best athletes. And that's something where curling has been completely outmanned over the last 20 years. That's primarily the reason that I started my junior Bondspiel back in the 90s and ran it for 17 years, was to get a longer season for kids and to get them into curling at a younger age. I want to ask you something about the junior events in general. First of all, with the competition aspect, but then also when we bring in kids at this age, how that you expect that to impact the amount of teams that we see at the provincial playdowns. Because we always had 78 teams at our junior Bondspiel and then 7 teams in the playdowns. So obviously there's a disconnect between kids curling and the competitive arm of our sport.
Yeah. And I think what we're trying to do with U15 is we're hosting regional events so that we're keeping kids closer to home. It's not, the focus isn't on bringing them all to a national, it's to get them to a regional event. And that is the goal, is to get more kids curling. And by opening it up to singles, it means, you know, somebody in a remote area or somewhere, they might not have a team. They might not be playing on a particular team. So what we're hoping is that this will give them an opportunity to meet other kids in their region, whether it's West, Prairie, East, or Atlantic. And, you know, to build, because one of the things with our sport that's really neat is you get to meet kids from other areas, whether it's from your own province or outside of it. So that's another piece that we want to tag into is, you know, I think part of the growth of the sport is going and meeting new kids from other areas.
Sure. So once this gets started and you get the regional aspect going, what's the communication like with these individuals that you deem to be, hey, these kids are good curlers? Like we have a chance to maybe mold them into the competitive ranks of our sport. So from playground to podium, like you're saying, you know, what I'm concerned about, which has been a real weakness in our ladder, if you will, you get lots of young kids curling and then 6 or 7 teams in a province playing the playdowns. And then you go, well, geez, there's nobody 25 years old curling. Well, no doubt. So that's where I really want to see this focus. And that's fantastic. But we need to make that, in Warren's words, the book, understanding who these top players are. And I guess I'd like to know from your point of view, from coaching and from communication, how do you intend to keep those top athletes involved in our game so they don't go over to volleyball, basketball, hockey, whatever the case may be?
Well, I think that's where we're trying to, have more discipline. So we'd like to see singles, doubles, triples, and fours. So we think by opening up multiple disciplines in our sport, that will provide kids with those opportunities because they might not want to play the traditional fours game. They might find triples to be really exciting and, you know, the movement in it, or they might love doubles. And we don't necessarily care if doubles are mixed doubles or, you know, same gender doubles. It really doesn't matter to us. We just think the discipline of that sport. We actually think that's going to be a game changer for us if we can get more clubs to offer the multiple disciplines of singles, doubles, triples, and fours and build the capacity in other disciplines.
So Helen, one of the things that is also interesting, we've been doing Zoom calls with curling clubs, and I won't mention the name of the club, but one we had here a couple of weeks ago, who had a very successful junior program. And I might say this isn't the only club we're hearing this thing from. So they had 300 juniors, but their big concern was that between the ages of probably 21 and 23, they were losing about 80% of them. And I'm thinking, is that the gap that's existed in here is to, we're going along this only competitive route, and then if you don't go competitive, where do you go from there? And I guess that now should pretty much be the job of the MAs and the clubs to put that together. But I see that as being one of the problems, based on what this club said and others, that they come up to the complete their junior age. They've been pretty competitive, but now maybe they're not going to be. And rather than continue in some other aspect of sport, they quit. So have we got anything in mind to try and help to bridge those gaps and what's happening with that?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And that definitely is a group that we have recognized year after year, we lose a lot of those athletes. And it's also a different time in their life. Some of them are in university, some of them are starting work, they're moving, relationships. So there are lots of factors that kind of go into it. And there are, you know, essentially different paths they could take. They could take the competitive path. So, you know, by doing that, we're hoping by offering a U25, you know, we'll kind of keep those competitive ones going. But that's where we would count on the clubs and the MAs to step in and maybe offer some more recreational opportunities for that group.
Helen, I got a question for you. I know if you want to get the youth involved, which obviously you have your heart and soul into this thing, is curling part of the curriculum of all elementary, middle schools, and high schools?
Absolutely not. And that's where we've been working with school districts to get curling in. So we do have some schools that have high school curling where kids can get credits. Mm-hmm. Some provinces have elementary school curling competitions, you know, and many provinces have high school curling competitions as well, but it's not ingrained into their phys ed programs. We would love for it to be, but it's very location specific based on the curriculum that's offered. I was a teacher for a very long time, mm-hmm. Actually in Calgary. I was a teacher in one particular school, and here I am, a high level coach, and I said, I'd love to be able to offer curling in this school, and I'll do it for free after school. I'll get the ice. And the answer was no, they weren't going to allow it. And so I went through so many different avenues. And so that particular school and district just decided curling was not going to be offered. And that was the end of that.
So no specific reason, just we don't want it.
I think when it comes to schools, they have various reasons why they can offer things and, you know, some activities and sports and not others. Some mm-hmm. of them become financial, some of them become, you know, just that's not what we do. So we're not going to offer it. Or, you know, I was really just trying to get them to, I just wanted kids to curl. It wasn't about going into a league or anything, just give them the opportunity to do that.
Mm-hmm. I think in some cases, and I know from a couple of situations I'm aware of, and I also look at the university situation of, they'll probably consider taking it into their curriculum as long as there's somebody there that can teach it, direct it, and take care of it. And I look at the situation today across Canada when the Curling Canada Instructor Program ceased to exist a number of years ago. I asked the question, do we have enough people out there around Canada today that know how to properly instruct the game? And I know a couple of provinces, I think Saskatchewan, Ontario in particular, have kept that going pretty good, but others haven't. Is that part of the problem, that we don't have good, solid instructors to maybe help at the school and the university level?
I think it's a great point, because we always talk about the coaching / instructor side of curling. And, you know, not every member association has paid staff. You know, some of them still operate on volunteers. And so when you take a look at the coaching stream and sort of the capacity that they have, every MA has a different system. So they all have, you know, different plans for how they're developing their coaches coming through youth and in adult play as well. It's definitely a gap that we need to address. You know, we offer the NCCP side. And so when coaches go to an under 18 event or under 21 or Scotties or Briar, they know what the certification is that they need. But we definitely need, you know, to work with the MAs to make sure that at the club level, there's a lot more opportunity for instruction, because that's what kids want. That's what adults want. They want to enter a league and they want to get better. And they need somebody on site who's able to help them.
It's a big problem, because I go back to when we started this program many, many years ago, when we had cut some very clear lines between coaches and instructors, because it's a pretty different aspect of what is required. And a good coach may not necessarily be someone who's going to properly instruct 20 people at one time, or whatever the case may be. And I think it's important, if we're going to grow all these things, that we've got people that are properly versed as instructors, not just coaches.
Helen, but back to the kids and the curriculums in schools and stuff that you said is, you know, that was impossible. You offered everything in the world and the schools still didn't do it. Is it tough to let kids know that curling is cool, or is it still, and I know it has for a long time and did, which frustrates anyone like yourself, that it's the image of it is the old guy thing and it's not cool? Or is that a frustration still with trying to get young kids involved?
I think it's less and less. You know, I think watching curling on TV is becoming, you know, it is kind of cool. Mm-hmm. We definitely ran into that before, where, you know, kids wouldn't exactly tell their friends, "Oh, I'm curling." And I think now it's like, "Oh, you're traveling here, you're going there," or, you know, it's kind of cool what they are doing. And the situation in the school was just one situation I was in. There are other schools that do right. offer curling. We just wish that it was in the curriculum and mm-hmm. had that opportunity. Like Heather Nedwin in Edmonton has a great scenario where she's got a school, you know, very close to her curling club. So some places have the ability, you know, it's set up where it could be easier, where others would, you know, there's no curling club within a 20-minute drive, which would be more difficult.
But Helen, I think it's really important that we get into the change of the junior age back to 20 years old, because I lived that. And so it was I sure like to hear when they got rid of that wait a year, because for me, back when I was young, we won Canada, had to wait a year. My team aged out. So the next year I had to try to operate two curling teams. Failed to win with my young team, failed to win the Worlds with the old team, because basically I split my time with two teams, and I think it certainly weakened our chances of winning. So now we going forward in time, and we go back to a really bad system, and I question the reason why, whereas we could have kept the system the same, splitting our season into two, a four-person season at the start, and then a mixed doubles, because, of course, that's an Olympic sport, a mixed doubles triple season, the second half, leaving it the same. I have to ask you, we go forward in time and make a bad blunder. I guess I need to hear from you why it's positive. I don't see it. So I guess I need to hear from you as to why it is.
Sure. I'm happy to chat about this. You know, I don't necessarily think this is a bad blunder. And I'm not sure why mixed doubles can't be in the first half of the season. And, you know, I don't know why mixed doubles I don't know why we need to sort of separate it. We could have a summer. We could start in the summer with mixed doubles and continue it into the fall. And, you know, so we can have mixed doubles at different times in the season. I don't think it has to sort of be partitioned. But when we went back and looked at our long-term athlete development model, and we were looking at under 21 kids, a lot of curling clubs across the country, they don't open till October. And so in Curling Canada's view, we've got to look at, you know, curling across the country. So with U21, the nationals were the end of January, which are exactly in the middle of exams. So there's a conflict there. The season was short for many of our under 21 teams. So if they had ice in September or October, most of our under 21 teams were done by January 1st, because they had their provincial competition, territorial competition. And if they didn't advance to the nationals, their season was over and they were switching teams. So there are many provinces that were struggling with how do they develop their junior teams when they're flipping halfway through the season. So we weren't even giving them enough opportunity to sort of play together. We're kind of giving them two half seasons. The kids were also running into an issue, because one thing we do in curling is we allow them to play up. So we want our U21 teams to be able to play in Scotties and Briar or Tankard playdowns. And so we were also running into the problem where the timing of the juniors was conflicting with some of those playdowns, causing conflict. The WCF used to have the World Juniors the middle of March. They moved it to the middle of February. So now we've got teams that are winning the end of January. And like our 2020 teams from Manitoba, they won the Nationals in BC at the end of January, and they were in Russia 2 weeks later. So there is absolutely zero time to prepare. You know, they've got to make changes with university courses right away. Some parents couldn't even make it because the logistics were too complicated to get to Russia. But we weren't really focused on the two particular teams that won. It was more about all of the athletes in Canada. We wanted to give all of our U21 athletes a chance to play a full season together. What we did is we essentially flipped the U21 and U18 schedule. So the U18s went earlier. So now they're in February and U21 is now in March. And what we noticed is most of our U21 kids actually play in our U21 playdowns. So what it meant is our U21 kids, their season was a full season, and now our U21 kids, they have a full season. So we were looking at the overall development of our younger athletes, giving them an entire season to play. And for many of them, it added 25% throwing time and competition time. And the other piece is so many of our junior teams, they were over competing and under training in the fall. They were just going crazy, going to spiel, to spiel, to spiel, to spiel, to try to, you know, almost make it a compact season of getting in as many competitions as they possibly could. And then if they didn't win after Christmas or early January, they were done.
But I guess this, I lived through this for 15 years, and I was the team leader of four of these teams when this all started back in the 70s, from 76 to 80, I was the team leader. And as Kevin had suggested, for those teams, I can't think of one scenario that was a good one out of it for those teams that had to delay a year of all the issues it created. So I don't know with one outweighs the other. I guess I would have to suggest, I would certainly hear what you're saying, but if there's maybe some other way, I'm guessing, why is the World Curling Federation putting this event into February? Is there not... I mean, this is the other problem with curling these days. I don't know why we have to complete everything by the 1st of April. They could have put the World Juniors, for that matter, into April. Is there any idea why they've got it in February and why they might not consider running the thing later? Because other countries have to be impacted by this as well. I would think from working with the U.S. the last few years that it certainly would impact them as well. Scotland probably also. So it just seems like, is this really the right solution?
We'd be happy if WCF would move the U21 World Juniors later in the season. Absolutely. But, you know, it starts middle of February, which is definitely a struggle for us.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, there's no reason for any of these world events, I don't believe, to be happening before March. And it comes back to the old story of why can't we be doing these world events in March, April, even into May? Today, there's no reason. Back 50 years ago, maybe there was to some degree. But we could have our curling season with these championships extend well into those months. And maybe it's a matter of there's going to be some strong lobbying done with the WCF with the help of maybe some other countries like Scotland and the USA as an example, because they also have fairly healthy junior programs.
I also wanted to jump in real quick and just mention our Universiad team. So whoever wins the U Sports every second year goes to the Universiad the following year. So we've been, our teams have been doing this for multiple Universiads where they win 1 year and then they go to the Universiad the next year. They would all say that that has been beneficial to them because they've been able to prepare. They've got longer time. We make sure that they have training opportunities. They're supported by Curling Canada. So we've had success with our U Sports teams. We've had success with our Youth Olympic teams where we've selected them the year before and had an opportunity to train with them. And some of them are on two teams, have been very successful on two teams. So it's, you know, maybe way back when wasn't a great scenario, but it definitely has worked out well for some of the teams that we've seen in the last decade.
This is really important to me because I hear all this stuff, but it doesn't make any sense. Okay, so mixed doubles is an Olympic sport. And we're talking about four-person curling and the teams needing more time for practice. And great, no problem, because a lot of curling, to your point, does start in October in a lot of places, even November in some places. So you're right, they don't have a whole lot of time. The problem that I see is we keep ignoring the elephant in the room, and that's mixed doubles. And if you've got all these four-person people going from till February, say, whatever the case may be, there's no plan for mixed doubles. And you said something about the summertime. Well, we just got done saying the curling doesn't start till October. So I don't know where that came from. But curling ends at about May 1st-ish, pretty much everywhere. Should it go longer? Warren and I have talked about this before. Absolutely, no problem. Let's keep curling going to the end of May to give more curlers and young people especially a better chance to compete and get better. But that's not the way it is right now. It's basically an October to end of April sport. And so if we have the Canadian Junior in January, and then it gives us time to work on mixed doubles, I just don't see where your top athletes, because that's who we really want to worry about. If they're worrying about four-person curling, which is great, they're not going to be worrying about mixed doubles. Top players don't worry about both right now, at least not much. Mixed doubles is sort of an add-on. But luckily, we have mixed doubles events going forward in adult curling, but we've just forgotten about it in junior. And by extending the four-person game into February, March, okay, waiting a year, you know, you brought up in the old days, I don't agree with you. I think it's still a problem. Universiad, I don't think it works very well there either, to be honest, by talking to the athletes. I hear from the athletes telling me this. I've got notes from a lot of your next gen people that I talked to in the last 2 weeks because I was going to come on this with you. So you may be correct, but for sure when it comes to mixed doubles, we are leaving that in the cold, and I just don't know why, being an Olympic sport, we need to get our athletes good at mixed doubles. And I'm at the Saville Center, which is a national training site, and there's just not a lot of mixed doubles going on there. And I worry that we're sort of leaving it out in the cold, and I don't really know why.
Well, we have an under 20 mixed doubles starting in 2023 at the Canada Winter Games. So we had that approved, I think it was 2 years ago. So we're already ramping up for under 20 mixed doubles. And so if you ask all of the provinces and territories, they all have some form of mixed doubles competitions lined up for next season to prepare for the Canada Winter Games. And then following the Canada Winter Games, we are already talking about continuing the under 20 mixed doubles. So to say that, you know, we're forgetting it or not, we're just, you know, there are a lot of conversations that aren't out there at this point in time, but we did release that all the MAs are aware that, you know, there's an under 20 mixed doubles occurring in PEI in 2023. We're really excited about that. And we want to continue and build from that. And with mixed doubles, just like adults, we're finding our top players are still in the four-person game as well. So we're open to see mixed doubles go in a different part of the season and make it all work, because it is a priority to us. So I know you think it isn't, but it definitely is.
Perfect. Yeah, well, time will tell for sure. That's great.
You put him in his place, Helen, okay? He needs some scolding. Don't take any stuff from him, okay? Why is there, I don't know if I'm talking way out of school here, but why do they have to have so many age categories for curling? Under U20 and over that, and U25, et cetera. Why is that?
Well, I think you'll find in any sport, there are multiple age categories. So when we went through our long-term athlete development, we started noticing that it was inconsistent across the country. So some places would have the word bantam meant three different age categories in different provinces.
Right.
So we changed it about 4 years ago to just, and we have it in 3 year ranges. So we've got U9, U12, U15, U18, U21. And then beyond that, U25 is sort of our catch-all with those athletes that Warren was talking about earlier that we really lose. You know, those young, the 21, 22, 23-year-olds, we want to make sure that, you know, we catch them in that U25 age category. So I think in curling, in other sports, they have them by 1 year. Like my daughter was in soccer. That was like U8, U9, U10, U11, U12. In curling, it doesn't, you know, we don't have the numbers that would support having events that would run for, you know, U15, U16, U17, U18. And we also have kids that don't always play with somebody who's exactly their age. They play with somebody around their age, and we also allow them to play up. So in some sports, you're not allowed to play up. If you're, you know, if you play U15 hockey, AAA, you play U15 hockey, AAA. You don't play U16 anything or U17 anything. So in curling, we allow flexibility. So that's why we have flexibility with our age groupings.
Okay. Everyone's getting along. This is fine. Okay. You guys are behaving yourself. You know, I worry about Kevin and Warren Helen. Okay. They can go sideways. Okay. They really,
yeah, Kevin,
can.
I don't know.
So obviously you're highly respected, Helen, because they don't respect me. Helen, talk about this next gen program for us.
So Curling Canada's next gen program started, we're in our third season. And it's funding from Own the Podium, Sport Canada, and Curling Canada. And this year we've got 6 men's teams, 6 women's teams, and 3 mixed doubles teams. And so we support them financially as well as with national coaching on and off the ice. In the last couple of years, we were able to run Next Gen Super Camps, which have been fabulous. So we bring all of the teams together with all our national coaches, have a training weekend together and sort of collaborate and come up with a plan as the teams have sort of worked on their gap analysis, and then we support them throughout the season. So this year, unfortunately, has been an off year where we've only been able to do online work with them. Right. You know, but athletes like Matt Dunstone, Corinne Brown, Tyler Tardy, you've had all of them on the program. They're all part of the Next Gen program. And so what our goal is to support them the best we can and hope that these athletes and teams end up in our national team program. So the Next Gen program is the feeder system to our national team program. The U25 event that we've created is an opportunity for teams that aren't as high on CTRS with appropriate ages. So Next Gen, we have younger teams. So we've got U25 teams, we've got U32 teams, and then for mixed doubles, we've got U30 teams. So we do have an age focus as well as CTRS standings with our Next Gen teams. And the U25 event that we created, we've been talking about this one for years. It's an opportunity for the teams that, you know, aren't as high on the CTRS list to have a play-in way of getting into the National Next Gen program. And it also gives us an opportunity to see those teams that are really close and provide some, you know, professional development for them too when they're with us. So we're really excited about that. And I would say of all of the topics that I get the most emails on, it's probably the under 25 event that we'll be hosting starting in September 2022.
Helen, this has been great. You sound like the right person for the manager of youth curling and Next Gen. I just want to ask you before you go, you'd mentioned something about an app. And I know a lot of the talk we have about, and a lot of, I know Warren has been certainly outspoken about this, that, to, you know, at the big events, Briar Scotties, other events, that we have to make this thing interactive. Where's Curling Canada? Is there a bunch of stuff happening technically with apps and all that? It must be all new ground for everyone over the last 5, 6, 7 years with this sort of stuff. Where's Curling Canada at?
Well, I think COVID provided us all an opportunity to do things a little differently this year. So that's where the singles app came from. We started working on that 2 years ago and we were able to finish it up this year. Mm-hmm. Curling Canada is looking at sort of an in-house app during events. I'm not involved in that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure sort of where they are in the whole process of it, but that's definitely, I've heard conversation about that.
Helen, fantastic. Thank you very much for coming on. And boy, you're sure doing great work for Curling Canada. And we look forward to what's ahead. We got the Scotty and the Briar coming up. The Scotties and the Briar coming up right now, and everyone's so anxious, yet so happy that it is happening. So Well done, Curling Canada. And thanks a lot, Helen. You can, how are you spending your time these days? When you're not doing curling stuff?
Well, my daughter luckily is in school. So during the day she's in school, and she's involved in lots of sports. So outside of that, I get to sort of run her around, and lots of people got a COVID dog or pet, and I didn't go that route. I got a COVID cottage. So I spend my time doing some renovations on that.
Well, when we all go down to the down east, we're going to stay at your cottage.
Okay? Absolutely.
Okay. Thanks again, Helen. We really appreciate you coming on. Take it easy and stay safe.
Thank you, everyone.
You bet.
Thanks, Helen.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot, Helen Radford, for coming on. That was that's fantastic. Every time there's a guest on, I don't feel very smart anymore because they're so smart, Kevin.
Yeah, Helen was really good, and I was so happy to hear this U15 Rockfest. That's something that's very, very important for the growth and being able to start to compete with other sports and build a book on our top athletes. So that is really good to hear.
So you're satisfied, Kevin, with what she had to say?
Which, all the stuff or that stuff? I like the U15 idea. Like, I definitely don't like moving the age down, wait a year. The young people I talk to, the young good athletes I talk to, don't agree with her. So I don't know where she's getting the information from. So you know what? We'll bring a young person on next week and we'll hear from them. Why not?
Yeah, we will. And I think I'll give them full credit. They're at least addressing the issue. I think it's a very difficult task. It's to some degree confusing, but everybody that's involved with this sport really has to get a hold of this junior youth thing, because if we don't, we're not getting the numbers in that we need to sustain the sport, and it's everybody's concern and everybody's problem.
Well, also, you know what else was totally curious? So you have this highly qualified coach in Helen Radford, who's a school teacher, okay? And then goes to her school, because she did say, no, not all the schools at all. It's not on the curriculum. So you've got it's a perfect setup, Kevin and Warren, for this girl to come in and say, this lady, and come in and say, let's put curling on there. And they go, no.
Yeah, I mean, it becomes very individual. You don't know the reasons deep down inside why some people make that position. I think it's got to be a constant lobby. It's got to be, you got to lay the thing, I think, wherever you're dealing with a school board or university, it's got to be laid out in front of them saying, here's what we'll do. Just let us do it. Because I think a lot of the times, if you start asking them to become teachers, instructors, or to do anything except give you the time, they may not do it. And I think that is one of the challenges.
And the fact that curling sheets, Kevin, are 20 minutes away from your school, put them on a bus, get them over there and get them throwing rocks.
But there's no simple solution. It's a challenge, but it's one that I think all resources that can be drummed up across the country have to be thrown towards it, of money and people.
Okay. We got other stuff to do. This is juicy. Let's go to the poll question, Warren. Fill us in with that and the results.
Well, we asked an interesting poll question this week with the Scotties coming up starting Friday as to who people thought might be the 8 teams that qualify. And I think some pretty interesting answers to a very large degree, as would be anticipated. But let's take a look. So out of Pool A, Team Canada, Einarsson, they got all the votes of approximately 335. Number two was Holman, Ontario, with 330. Walker, Alberta, 281. And then the wild card team, number two, young team out of Manitoba, Zacharias, came in at 135. And then Kerry Galusha from the Northwest Territories at 53. So I'll go through this, and then Kevin and I will talk about it if we agree with sort of what the people have suggested here. Then we look at Pool B. Manitoba, Jones with 340 on top of the list. Wild card number one, the Fleury team with Kerry as the skip, was 296. The interesting one here, picked as number three, PEI team, Suzanne Britt, 235 points. Interesting, coming from Prince Edward Island, but she is number nine on the Canadian team ranking system list. And then it gets pretty close for the position four. We've got Sherry Anderson, Saskatchewan skip, at 194. But then right in the midst of it is Corinne Brown from BC with 182. So five teams really neck and neck in the B pool. Kevin, what do you think about the A pool?
Well, you know, it wasn't a big surprise. It actually didn't go the way I voted. It was close, but no. So it's very interesting. I like the fact that we had about 2,600 votes, Warren.
Yeah, that's good.
That's an incredible wow. amount of people. Yes, Jimmy, an incredible amount of people voting. I really like the territories getting into the final eight this year. I really, really do. But 53 votes, that's solid, but I expected Galusha to get a little bit more than that.
Yeah, I look at it interesting too. I think if there was every year that Kerry Galusha may have a shot, this is it, because most of these teams haven't played much. And she's got Joanne Rizzo playing third for her, good player out of Ontario. So I would give them a fighting chance to get in that last four in that A pool. And in that B pool, Corinne Brown and Sherry Anderson, neck and neck. I would think Corinne Brown, with the experience she's gotten so far, younger, I would maybe look to maybe her having the edge there. But it should be interesting as to which of the teams do come out. And if it's those four of those five that we've mentioned there, and then the other side, it's the same thing. If it's four of those five that we've talked about, if somebody else is able to kind of slip in there through the back door.
Well, especially when it comes to BC curlers being able to practice more than the Prairies, and Bert out in PEI being able to curl all winter. So, yeah, I think the youth of Corinne Brown and being able to practice a lot could end up ahead of the veteran out of Saskatchewan.
Now, I want to make a statement to one of our fans who wrote a little statement on our Facebook page about our polls. And he says, inside curling is all about moving the hearts and briar away from being a provincial territorial competition to a best of the best competition. This poll is designed for you to vote for the best teams. And then they can say, see, no one wants to see the weaker provinces or territories in these competitions. So let me make it clear that we did not shape the poll in any way, shape, or form for it to be that way. The fact is, the way the program that our high-tech guy is using, in fact, puts the highest number out as it's being tallied. It's been suggested to me there may be other polls that we could use, but unfortunately, this is the one we're using. So there is no intent of putting the weak teams at the bottom and the good ones at the top.
It's just off of votes. That's it. Nothing else.
Yeah, we're looking at it all in this case equally, and we'll see what happens at the end of the day as to who does come out into those eight positions.
Not everyone brings us the love. Right? They don't always bring us the
big
love.
Question is,
okay, boys. Keep going. We got more to talk about. We'd like to thank Rod Paulson and his company In-House Strategies for all the great work they're doing on our social media. It really is good. Rod spends most of the day putting up posts. He brings a huge amount of experience from the advertising world, and we want to thank him for his involvement. Also, Inside Curling is reaching out to curling clubs all over the world and inviting you to contact us and ask us to set up about a one-hour Zoom call with me and Kevin and Warren to discuss anything you would like about curling. Please keep in mind, we're doing this on a limited basis, okay, to see how it goes. And it is going well. So if you want to consider that, we'd love to offer that to you. We've heard from a number of clubs, but we want to emphasize that we're looking to do a call with a number of club members and not just a couple of people. So get your crew together, and we'll give you a little private, semi-private Zoom call. That would be great. We'd love to do it. To date, we've done we've done 8 sessions with clubs in Canada, US, and Europe, including Belgium, Wisconsin, Detroit, and Barrie, Ontario. And we'd love to have you guys on to do that. And we'll discuss anything. Warren, you'll take on anybody, won't you? You'll take on anybody.
No, Jim, we'll discuss things with people. We'll discuss.
Okay. Kev, something happened last week about the dough that people are playing for at the slams, and it must be important here. Kevin's got to make a correction to a statement about the money that's played for at the slams.
Yeah, all it was last week was just a number that was incorrect, and we actually edited it out of last week's show because it was just John Shea. He's a super nice guy and just misspoke, so I just wanted to clear something up. And so the Grand Slams are... We're talking about the biggest events, money events, and all that stuff. So the Grand Slam property has 6 events, just so everybody knows, 6 events, and it's $2.1 million in prize money. So the way it breaks down is that the Masters event, and now remember, it's men and women, correct? So it's $300,000 up for grabs, $150,000 to the women, $150,000 to the guys. The Tour Challenge, now this is the great event that has the Tier 1, and the Tier 2. 340,000 total, 240 to the Tier 1 event, 100,000 to the Tier 2 event. The National, 300,000. The Canadian Open, 300,000. The Players' Championship is kind of the one that is big. It's 350,000 in prize money, but then the Pinty's Cup is awarded at the Players' Championship. That's another 300,000. So 650,000 is paid out at the Players, and then 210 at the Champions Cup. Now, the Pinty's Cup is that 300,000 that's given out the Players. That's 300,000 as well. Then you add it all up, it's 2.1 million. Just want to make that clear because, we just had a bit of a misunderstanding last week, and maybe that's not common knowledge across curling circles. So just want to clear that up, Jimmy. So I appreciate that.
So you think the dole will keep going up, Kevin? I mean, COVID has kind of screwed things up.
Yeah. No, this year is a mess of all kinds, and talking to hell, and of course, it messes everything up. But yes, it's very successful, doing extremely well, and it has been going up, and it will continue to, of course.
Right. Good for curling. Got over 2 mil in dole. Does that make you want to come back, Kev?
No. the young players are too good. They're too good.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Kevin, and all you Facebook people. That's great. Keep it coming. So what's the plan, you guys, for our show with the Scotties and the bubble event and the Briar? What are we going to do?
Well, what we plan on doing is kind of doing a little bit of a synopsis at the end of each day. We'll put up the standings on our Facebook site, and we'll put in some comments that maybe will give people an opportunity to agree or disagree with what we have to say, and just try and create a spot for following each day. People can come and have a little discussion on what took place that day and where they think things are going to be going the next day. So yeah. Join our Facebook group.
Right on. I can't imagine that people wouldn't want to hear from me each day, Warren. I just can't.
Well, Jim, I want to see you put some comments in that Facebook group. I haven't seen any yet.
Get in there
and say, hey, anybody want to talk to me?
Yeah. Well, now I'm going to do it. The guys are taking you on. It's getting lively, Warren. Hey, Kev, it's getting lively. It's getting very lively. Okay. We got an email from Tanner Nathan. And he says, you guys have been saying you want more and more of the top rated teams at the national championship this whole time. Now, in the last episode, you said you think the right number of teams to be at Olympic trials could be 8. I don't see the logic here. Please explain, as I'm sure many listeners were scratching their heads hearing that one. So what's he referring to, Warren? Is he talking about you want 8 for the trials, but you want 20 for the Briar?
Well, first of all, I can understand why it may be a little confusing. I think what we talked about is the original Olympic trials were 8. And that was up until 2010. And I guess it was 8 initially because I was involved in those discussions because of the whole way teams were ranked and positioned at that point in time. And the money coming from the funding agencies was directed at 6. So it's thought by taking it to 8, you're pretty much including anyone who you felt would be a team that you'd want to represent Canada at the Olympics. When we talked last week about possibly at the Scotties and Briar of saying more teams might be better, I think it needs to be probably defined, clarified, and the fact that it seems as if everyone is hung up with the 14 provincial territory teams having to be part of the Briar and Scotties. And so what we were suggesting, if that's the case, if you were to take the number of teams in both of those events to 20, what you would probably ensure at that point in time is having the top 10 ranked teams in the country in the event for sure, along with the 14 provincial territorial representatives. So that's why we made that statement. But I don't think it was suggesting that we feel that more teams is the answer, that less isn't. Kevin, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I do like the 8 number. Or, I guess you can go to 9, but you don't want to go much further than that when it comes to Olympic trials because, when it comes to a funding model, how the sport gets funded, it's all about podium, getting on the podium at the Olympic Games. So you don't want to go too far down that list and have somebody get hot for 1 week and maybe come out of a 12th or 13th or 14th ranking, because in order to be ranked at 12, 13, or 14, either means that you win once in a while or you're not consistent. Well, that's not the team you want at the Olympics. You want somebody who's really, really good and consistent, gives you the best possible chance to get on the podium. And that helps the funding of our sport. So keeping the number fairly tight, be it 8 or 9, maybe 10 at the absolute most for the trials makes sense to me.
It's interesting. We've had some spirited discussion going on today on our Facebook page with a lot of our young guns who see the Olympic pre-trials as an opportunity for them to gain some experience and maybe if a couple of things go in the right direction for them for them to get into the trials. And there seems to be comments by some feeling, well, if one of those teams is good enough to come through that week and win, great for them. And I guess this is why people like the Canadian Olympic Committee and Own the Podium look at it as a four-year venture, is looking who is the best teams over a four-year period versus possibly 1 week. And while someone could get hot in any circumstances and win in a given week, the question is, can they maybe keep that going a couple of months later when you get to the Olympics? And your best chance of having consistency is going to be the people that have shown it over the long haul. And it's not to say anything more or less for the other teams coming up the ladder. I understand that there's got to be events for them to reach the pinnacle that they're all shooting for. And I think it's another area that needs a lot of discussion and a lot of looking at tier one, tier two, tier three, and developmental aspects.
So, Kev, what do you think about the whole idea that the previous winner of the Scotties or the Briars gets an automatic entry into it the following year?
You mean just Team Canada into the Briar and Scotties?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's fine. It's obviously a very strong team, whoever that may be. And it's somebody to put on the poster, you know, well in advance, because other teams aren't known. So I see nothing wrong with having Team Canada in there. It's no problem at all. And if you're going to have the 14 provincial and territorial reps, then 20 is probably a reasonable choice so that you have at least your top 8 to 10 teams in your national championship. That's important.
Okay, we're out of time. We're out of time, you guys. We could, you know, this show could be on one big loop. We could just keep going more. 24 hours.
Maybe we should do a 5-hour show one day.
Yeah, we get so many comments on Facebook, right? They come out every second. We could just be reacting to this and have a inside curling-a-thon. We could have a 3-day straight show for 72 hours. Kev, tell us about our guest next week. Who's coming on?
Yeah, we have a terrific guest coming on. Tanner Horgan is going to come on, and that's one of the next gen players. Obviously, one of our strong young players in Canada. And I'm really interested in hearing a couple of things, and that's what Tanner thinks of this next gen program, the way it's set up that Helen told us about today. But then we've been getting some emails about Purple Hearts, and if we're going to go to 20 teams in the Briar and Scotties, does everybody get a Purple Heart? What's a Purple Heart mean to a young player coming up that inevitably is going to win one? Well, we're going to find out next week from Tanner Horgan.
Yeah, you're going to upset a lot of old guys, older guys.
I'm an old guy. I'm not upset about it.
Okay.
Tanner might say, Jimmy, that, oh, man, it's the absolute thing I need to try to win that Purple Heart. Because that's the way I looked at it when I was a kid, Jim. Sure. Well, maybe Tanner still looks at it that way. Maybe he does. Let's see. We'll find out next week.
Warren, are you going to have something to say that maybe the Purple are they too easy to get now, Warren? Save it. Save it for next week.
We'll save it for next week.
Okay. Thanks a lot, everybody. You can email us at insidecurling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter at curlinginside, Facebook at insidecurling, and of course, we're on Instagram as well at Inside Curling Podcast. Thanks, everyone, for the emails. We love to get them, and we love to pour over as many as we can. So the shorter you keep it, the bigger chance you have of us talking about it. But we appreciate everyone's passion. The show's growing and growing, and we love doing it. So thanks a lot, boys. Very good show this week. Thanks a lot to Helen Radford. And thank you to you guys for keep listening to Inside Curling. We'll talk to you next week, boys.
Thanks, Jimmy.